Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
And a very warm welcome back to Solidarity Breakfast.
A left response to the major developments in capitalism.
What they trade in is not wheat. They trade in famine.
A little dose of revolutionary optimism.
I think it's really important to sort of express solidarity globally.
It really is a deal by corporations for corporations.
The union forever defending our rights. Down with the black leg.
If you think the ABC's left wing, don't listen to this program.
Solidarity Breakfast, 7:30 to 9 a.m. Saturdays, 3CR, 8:55 a.m. Streaming and 3CR digital, podcast or audio on demand. And of course, the website, solidaritybreakfast.org.au.
Solidarity forever!
Good morning, everybody. It's a rainy day for Solidarity Breakfast. I've done the weather report. G'day, Anila. How are you?
I'm good. Pretty tired. But I also think it's worth mentioning it was your birthday earlier in the week.
Yes.
So that's pretty exciting. But I was going to say, if anyone wants to get Annie a birthday present, save it up for Radiothon next month.
Yes, that's right. It's crept up on us. It's like a, you know, like a disease or black
Hopefully
death.
A bit nicer than that.
All of a sudden it's Radiothon again. You think, oh my God, we've done it, we've made it, and we did a really good job last year. So, and that obviously means that the listeners have done a great job because you've supported us and you need us and we love you. So put some money into our coffers for a June Radiothon. I don't quite know what the dates are, but it's something in between, in the middle.
That's helpful.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll have more information for you next week.
Yeah, yeah, once we're alert. But anyway, and Tobias, how are you?
Yeah, yeah, good, good.
Yeah,
my,
yeah.
My mum came this week, so we've just been going
we've
out and
live
doing
studio
stuff.
Audience today.
Yeah, canned laughter. Yeah. No canned laughter today. It's been good. We've just been out. We went to the ASU rally on Tuesday. I mean, we just heard the Stick Together program where Amy interviewed an ASU organizer, and so it was good to hear that, and then kind of confront that with or like put that against what we saw on Tuesday.
It was a very large rally.
It was a very large rally. It was an interesting rally. It was one that, at least from what we saw, gave the voice to council workers. So there was large opportunities for actual council workers and actual organisers that did a lot of the work in doing this, you know, multi-council bargaining agreement, were able to say what their opinions was. But I think we were noting that there's a bit of an absent presence when we talk about, when we hear talked about inflation and cost of living, but without it being able to be tied to the material reality, like,
well,
around
some,
the world.
Yeah, and as some people have said, you know, people are working all the time. It's got nothing to do with hard work. It's about not actually being able to make ends meet. And so the council workers are a perfect example of this because they work right across a whole range of services, you know, from the bin men to, could be bin women too, I don't know, but a whole range of services that keep the local municipalities are ticking over. People don't notice that they're doing all this work until the work is not actually being done.
And it's a shame that we kind of didn't learn our lesson from COVID, when it became incredibly obvious which roles are essential to keeping a society ticking over. One of the biggest ones was these kind of service industry jobs. And we've repaid them very poorly for that contribution.
Yeah, exactly. And this leads on to the headline coming out of the CPSU from Victoria, coming out of the Victorian election, where they're vying the candidates, the Liberal and particularly the Liberal and Labor candidates, vying for the worst attacks on the Victorian Public Service, thinking that once they go into bat for to win the election, that it's a winning thing to cut services to the Victorian public by sacking 70,000 public servants.
Yeah.
I mean, why is that a winning position to take for the Liberal, whatever her name is?
It's also interesting because that was obviously an incredibly unpopular platform for Peter Dutton in the federal election. So it's interesting that they've revived it at the state level.
Well, it ties into, I know this sounds like a sort of a left field thing, but they've just had local council elections in England, and Reform has taken about 14 of the councils. And someone was going through the background to those wins. Many of the places that have taken on Reform are the ones that lost industries 20 years ago or earlier because of the greed of neoliberalism, the coal mining places, the textile factories that were outsourced to Bangladesh for slave labour. That's another angle of oligarchs and their corporate greed across the world. Many of these places that put Reform into their local councils wrongly believe have been fed the notion that the reason for why the coal mines were closed is because the Greenies don't agree with it, when in actual fact they obviously have no history. They forget Thatcher. They don't remember the battles on the ground, which seems pretty amazing to realise that the thousands of police who beat up on the miners, people have got amnesia.
Yeah, and I mean, so just the figures were that for the CPSU thing that you the headline you were mentioning is that the Liberal Party announced as its policy, one of its policy platforms, that the first cab off the rank should be $22 billion in budget savings, what they're calling it, and actually what it
savings when it's cut.
What they actually translate to is 7,000 Victorian public sector job cuts.
7,000
job cuts, which means what we saw earlier.
I mean, and there's already been progressive cuts over time.
Yeah, like the state library ones that we saw a rally at. A lot of these essential jobs that we don't think about how useful.
Well, they've already cut. The Labor people have already cut when they were talking about frontline staff. You know, they keep talking about the difference between frontline and backroom staff as if the people who are working behind the scenes are not the same people that are making the system work. Having someone, I mean, anybody who's rung an information line and had someone say, be nice to you on the line, but you can't actually get anything to happen, knows perfectly well that having a backroom support to frontline workers is absolutely essential. So what we're really saying is that these politicians have no idea how the system works.
I was going to say, I think it just boggles my mind that these people keep on getting involved in government that clearly have a complete disregard for the systems of government. Like, say what you will about a bureaucratic state, but I think one of the benefits of it is it has these highly systematized organizational structures that make your society fairly well organized.
The rubbish gets collected.
Yeah, exactly. You have a government that functions.
Well, also, like, the other aspect was, you know, that we were reflecting on sort of as a group after with some of our friends that were ASU organizers there, and we were talking about what makes up a council worker, like what do they do, how do they think of themselves, and then how does the union view them? Because even linking back to the interview that we had with Don a few weeks ago, where he was talking about the chant, you know, union power, depends where you put that power in the, you know, union bureaucrats or
grassroots,
or in the grassroots, or if you put it with members, or and that's where the power thing. So, talking about that would be how do we expand this vision of what union members see themselves as and how their organization functions and what it's meant to represent? Because if it is just about pay, then that kind of means that, you know, the drive to war and councils allowing defense spending in their councils is fine as long as everyone gets paid more.
Yeah, exactly. And of course it's not.
And we know what it looks like when these systems do fall apart. We can look at America. I was in the US last year in New York, and obviously it's one of the most progressive parts of America. It's also one of the wealthiest parts of America. Rubbish wasn't being collected. There was rubbish everywhere. Central Park, one of the biggest landmarks in the city, weeds everywhere. So when you don't have government actually doing what government does, it visibly reduces people's quality of life, not to mention the more kind of pernicious ways that a lack of government destroys people's lives systematically. But it has a real impact, and you can go to a country like America to see what happens when you don't have state services functioning properly.
That's really funny. Now that you've taken us to Central Park, I really wanted to talk about Chris Smalls. Chris Smalls, who was the founder of the first successful union at the Amazon, now met the Met Gala, apparently, because Australia is now a suburb of America, apparently. And so they reported on this bizarre event on the end of many of the legacy news on TV.
To see it reported in The Guardian.
I mean, that's exactly the right. Dress, for some reason or other, we're supposed to be interested. But the most interesting thing about it was that Chris Smalls and his people were demonstrating out the front, and they'd done this really interesting thing. They put a whole lot of beakers of fake urine all through the entire place to represent the fact that Amazon workers don't have enough time to go to the toilet because of the pressure on their for their, you know, maintaining their jobs. And the reason why it's completely related to Amazon is because Bezos and his woman, his partner, who looks like, all of them look like Donald Duck because they've all had things done to their faces, and they all wear clothes that bring tuck into their hips like they're from, you know, like Jessica Rabbit. So they're all playing some mind game that we're all supposed to be part of. I don't know, because they're representatives of the way you're supposed to look. Anyway, he's put up the big bucks for this particular event. It costs $100,000 a ticket to go to that event. The past of that, the event is for an institution that was given land for free, public land. It's in Central Park. In 1870, it was given this land, and it was on the proviso that it should be open and free for the public to come to this event, you know, to this museum. And now they have a discretion. You have to pay $30 to go in there. You know, like they say it's voluntary, but you actually have to pay $30 to go in there. So it's no longer free. And the electricity bill is paid by the public, right? All this stuff that's so weird. And you know what the theme for this year was? Because it's the money is apparently going for the payment of the workers and for the upkeep of the costume section of the museum, right? All the other money is to keep the place going is public money, right? And all this money goes in that they raise. And the theme was black male dress as a form of resistance. And so out the front.
I think this is actually fake news. Sorry, Annie. That was last year's theme.
No, this year's theme.
No, this year's theme was fashion as art.
Fashion
as art.
No, fascism as art.
Not fascism. Fashion as art. But that was last year's theme.
Really? Yeah. But anyway, it's pretty hilarious.
It is.
Because it was live art out the front with Chris Moores being mozzed by the coppers.
Yeah. But even if that was last year's theme, there are many, many examples of how kind of obviously, I don't know what the word is for it, but you've got this kind of...
It's weird.
There, for instance, there was someone wearing a dress this year that I think the title...
Like meat or something.
No, there was a title. No, not that crazy. There was a title of a dress called like Tax the Rich or something like that. A participant at the Met Gala was wearing.
Yeah, AOC was wearing it.
No. That you guys are just very far behind on your Met Gala news. That was about 5 years ago.
Okay, all right. Go on, get on with it.
The point is, there's this kind of, this spectacle of class consciousness that goes on and racial consciousness that goes on at this event, even though it's kind of this massive display of excess happening in a city where as soon as you walk out the doors of the Met Gala, you're surrounded by essentially poor black people. It's a city full of people who are unhoused, and most of those people are not white people. So yeah, it begs belief that these people kind of can't see the hypocrisy.
Well, that's funny you should say that, because one of the socialist papers said, "What is it about the Met Fashion Gala that leads one to think fondly of the guillotine?"
I can understand that.
Anyway, I thought that was really funny.
Well,
but
speaking of, American hypocrisy, we've also had some updates in Empire News this week. We've had Cuba sanctions being ramped up and specifically targeting Cuban companies this week. So Grupo de... Sorry, everyone, for the pronunciation in advance. Grupo de Administración Empresarial S.A., I hope that wasn't too difficult to listen to. Sorry, everyone. Which is a conglomerate controlled by the country's military with ties to nearly all segments of its economy, and the executive president of the company have been sanctioned, as well as Cuba's state-owned nickel company's joint venture with a Toronto firm, Sherritt International. They've been targeted directly. The UN has responded to these sanctions by... Actually, three special rapporteurs have responded by condemning the sanctions as an unlawful blockade, which is not only disrupting daily life, but also undermining the enjoyment of a wide range of human rights. So it's not all pretty frocks in the United States at the moment. They're destroying people's lives abroad.
Can we talk about something that you discovered the pursuit of gas?
This is some of the scariest news this week for me. The Minns government in New South Wales has announced that they're going to be opening up new areas in the far west of the state for gas exploration. This is after a more than decade-long pause. So they had previously been listening to communities that had, particularly the Lock the Gate campaign had pushed back against this kind of exploration as destructive to local communities, agriculture, the environment, obviously.
Like everything.
Yes. So it's a pretty big backflip from the New South Wales Labor government. A Greenpeace Australia Pacific ambassador has criticised the Labor government for, quote, once again bending over backwards to please the gas lobby. This is Soleil Snyder from Greenpeace. She went on to say that... this is not going to solve any problems. Any new gas coming from the far west would be more expensive than renewable energy and take decades to come online. It would also destroy the environment, cause enormous irreversible climate damage, and delay the transition to what is irrefutably a cheaper, cleaner source of energy, renewables. The government, this is the part that is, pretty shocking.
Flabbergasting.
The government announced that it will open up the Banchania and Pondy Range troughs for gas exploration applications. And these applications, previously the fee was $50,000 for an application. It's now being reduced to $1,000. So they're essentially saying, we're giving away this land for free.
And of course...
Please come mine.
And the gas is complete... This exploration is completely unnecessary, not needed. And the Minns government just throws disaster upon disaster. Following discussion yesterday with the Minns Labor government and members of parliament, the New South Wales Aboriginal Land Council confirms that Aboriginal land rights in New South Wales is under attack following the introduction of a recent bill by the Minister for Lands and Property. Without consultation or notice, the Crown Lands Management Amendment Bill 2026 was introduced in Parliament under the guise of miscellaneous minor amendments, but they're not minor. This is an attack by stealth. The New South Wales government deliberately introduced an amendment to another bill to allow out their rights under the Aboriginal Land Rights Act 1983, one of the most significant land restitution frameworks in Australia. If passed, the changes will erode land rights in New South Wales and overturn more than 40 years of hard work. The proposed changes will override the decision of the High Court in Quarry Street, which reconfirmed the long-settled law that the lawful use of Crown land in relation to the ALRA must include the land being physically used, and that simply holding a lease over land does not mean a land claim can be refused. The proposed changes will give the New South Wales government broad powers to retrospectively validate unlawful leases issued by the minister. No other law in New South Wales deals with the lawful use of Crown land. There is no need for provisions to have a retrospective effect, more other than to defeat Aboriginal land claims. It's pretty grim, actually.
I also think the fact that the federal and state Labor governments are perpetually, and you know, rightfully so when you consider the rise of far-right ideologies in Australia, preoccupied with the radicalisation of the Australian public. And I just think, like, what do you...
Maybe they're intending it.
Maybe, but I just think I cannot imagine a more predictable outcome than government being less transparent, less trustworthy and less effective than radicalising people.
Well, it does, to me, it's a bit like having watched a cattle dog and two cattle dogs and a farmer corralling a whole bunch of sheep into a particular space. And it sounds like to me that most of the politicians are the sheep, not the cattle dogs. The business about government, Labor governments giving a free kick to big business, it came to my attention this week that anybody who puts their house up for sale and uses an online service, which is all monopolised by Murdoch interests in Australia, has to pay $4,000 just for a listing online. In America, the same service is free. In England, it costs $100. So
it's cheaper to apply to frack gas than it is to list a home.
Online. You're on Solidarity Breakfast with Annie, Tobiah and Anila.
This last big loud as we can, because I don't think they can hear us yet, do you?
No!
We live in a world where they'll start a war just to make some more money than they had before. They've neglected their responsibility, too caught up in political hypocrisy. But the time is up. Gonna change. This is where I hear the people say.
Time.
back.
Thank you, Annie. We are back. We're going to move now to our coverage of the Middle East, our weekly updates about Palestine, and we'll hear from the region first. There's been a pretty big update in terms of the very fragile ceasefire between the US and Iran. So the US this week has bombed Iran's Qassem port. This obviously violates the terms of the very precarious ceasefire that has been in place since April. Fox News reporter Jennifer Griffin was the first to report on the US strikes. Qassem Island, where the port was bombed, is in the Strait of Hormuz, and as well as this port, the Iranian port city of Bandar Abbas was also bombed. It's the same area where the US previously had bombed an elementary school on February 28th, killing 120 children. The strikes have led to an immediate escalation in the conflict. Iran said that its forces responded to the US attacks in the region by targeting US warships, and US Central Command released a statement that said three US Navy destroyers came under attack while transiting the Strait of Hormuz. Trump told ABC reporter Rachel Scott that the US bombing of Iranian ports was, quote, a love tap, and that the, quote, ceasefire is going, it's in effect.
Yeah, which is basically supremo gaslighting. We're going to go and hear a voice for Palestine, Dr. Munta Imad. He was speaking at a church, a Pitt Street church in Sydney called People for Peace and Justice event.
And now it's my great pleasure to introduce Dr. Munzer Imad. He was born in Gaza. He earned his first degree from Bethlehem University. He's a PhD in law from Western Sydney University and a senior policy officer with the New South Wales government, working on justice and crime prevention, focusing on multicultural policy and engagement. A Linking Hearts ambassador, he's also shared his expertise in the sphere of domestic and family violence in Australia. He received the New South Wales Premier's bushfire emergency citation for disaster welfare efforts. When I had a little chat with him just before, he also spoke about non-violent resistance and talked about Mahatma Gandhi, and it was a very short conversation that I hope to continue. Please welcome Dr. Munzer.
Thank you so much. And good to see so many familiar faces. It doesn't get any easier to be here again and call for peace and coexistence. At times, it feels naive. And yes, thanks, Omar, for emphasizing on that point, to actually advocate for just peace during such darkness. I even sometimes wonder if our standing together means ignoring the suffering of my Palestinian people. I, however, know for sure that it is harder to remain silent. It is even more painful to surrender to hate and fear. It would be everyone's loss if we accept dehumanization as the norm of our lives. I come to you today to be the voice of Palestinian children. For once, we need to see Palestinians from the lens of their children. My mom and dad were little children when they were forced out of their village in 1948 and have lived all their lives in a refugee camp in Gaza. I was one of the 15 kids that mom and dad brought to life in Gaza. Let me take you through a journey of what it's like for Palestinian children to live under occupation, by sharing a snapshot of my childhood. I was under 14 years of age when the first intifada triggered in 1987. I lived through this life as a teenager, under most of those days under curfew. I still remember the first curfew in the refugee camp. We call it the 17 days curfew. It was the longest curfew we lived under. I was only around 14, 15 years of age. As you can imagine, as a teenager living under curfew, what it would be like for you. So naturally, I still remember I broke that curfew so many times where I had to go outside the house. I still remember one day where basically I had to go to the nearby village to actually bring food to my family, trying to be the protector of my family and carrying a bag of vegetables and coming back to a refugee camp. I still remember one day that I actually left the door unlocked and slightly jarred during the curfew where the soldiers stormed inside the house. I was lucky not inside the house. And they actually beaten my dad for not locking the door. I still remember when the curfew was lifted, I went to my high school. As like normal days, we had some clashes with the Israeli soldiers. And then my first experience, when my best school friend got a rubber bullet, and that's landed in his head, and immediately lost his life. His name is Farid Limghari. Farid would be around my age now. He would be around over 50 years of age. You can imagine the potential and opportunities for Farid to be like me today, with 7 degrees and having children and living a life of full potentials. And we have lost Farid, like so many. I still remember as well that one day I was caught being outside the curfew where I was severely beaten and put into in military detention for 7 months. I also still remember one day I was actually standing with literally would be Hani, my brother, older brother, standing next to me during a demonstration, and we were arguing together that we should go, perhaps go back home. And he received a bullet inside, got into his tummy, and it was an explosive bullet. He was in intensive care for a few months, but thankfully he survived. When I walked out of detention, you can imagine as a teenager, I was confused, full of rage, not sure what to make of my world as a Palestinian child. Thankfully, Beit Lahem University welcomed me, and I got accepted to study psychology and sociology, full of scholarship based on a humanitarian ground. I actually still remember weirdly, now remember it, the first two elective subjects that I decided to actually study was two things. Music, to study piano, and the second subject was actually studying Hebrew. I've never thought it, and it never became clear to me why now, after almost 30 years, why I decided to choose those two subjects. Now it became clear why I decided to choose those subjects. Music to try to heal, Hebrew to try to understand. So instead of trying to understand the consequences of forcing a whole society under military occupation, we sadly normalized hate and violence. For 79 years, we have failed to understand each other. We refuse to accept that we both have equal right to be free and live with dignity. The past 3 years have led to our biggest moral failure by refusing to recognize that we both belong to the same human race and we share the same precious land and we both have legitimate needs to be free, to feel safe and free. A just peace can only be achieved by understanding, not through force and dehumanization. The real courage is to refuse that one people is better than another, And the real courage is to stand up against hatred, even when we are grieving. No solution will come out of violence and vengeance. The bombing of Gaza has only deepened the cycle of hate. Looking at you today, however, makes me feel you are the faces of a solution that Palestinian and Israeli people need to resolve the root causes of their conflict, which is the lack of acceptance and understanding of each other. By standing together, you represent hope over fear and despair, equality over supremacy and extremism, solidarity over polarization and discrimination. Thank you for showing the way out of the current mess by reclaiming our moral standard and ending the occupation and coexist equally. Thank you.
Sono Grazia. You're listening to 3CR, Radical Radio.
And you're back with Annie, Tobias and Anila on Solidarity Breakfast. And we're going to go to another recording done by our wonderful compatriot, Vivian Langford from Sydney. She did that recording. And this one, which is of a man who's got a fantastic name. His name's Bob Treasure, and he is the president of the Australian Cuba Friendship Society, and he was speaking at a Philip Sydney event dedicated to helping Cuba.
Just before then, we'll just hear one more song.
Oh, you're what?
Here on this most important commemoration. I wanted to thank Frank for his acknowledgement of country. At the start, it's become a bit of a political football at the moment, but it's being stirred up by certain influences in our society, and it needs to be stamped out because it's the least we can do, is to show our respect to the First Nations people who once cared for the land that we're meeting on tonight. So thanks for that, Frank, and thanks for the invitation too to the ACFS that the FELAF comrades have issued to us. It is an honour to be here tonight and to share some of our thoughts about what's happening in Cuba. I've got to commend Frank and FELAF for those short documentaries that you saw tonight. Much of what I wanted to talk about is already explained in those documentaries about the Cuban health system, about ELAM, the Latin American School of Medicine. Does anybody here, put up your hand, does anybody here know of any country in the world, any country, first, second, third world, whatever, who has a similar system of allowing people from impoverished backgrounds the capacity to train as the doctors they want to be helpful and constructive members of their own society? Does anybody know of anything like ELAM anywhere else in the world? Only Cuba. I mean, it's actual shameful to say. I was going to start my speech about my connection to Italy. My daughter married an Italian. He came from Ischia, little island off Naples. And when they wanted to set up and start a family, they couldn't find a home in Sydney here. It was too expensive, nor up the mountains. They had to go to regional Australia up the mid-north coast. And they bought a home in Nambucca Heads. And when she was having her child, Rhiannon was overdue. And so she was taken to Coffs Harbour Hospital, and there she was induced. But she was induced along with six other mothers, all to have their birth on the same day. And the reason why it was organised that way was that there was only a visiting obstetrician that came once a fortnight, and it had to all happen, all the births had to happen on that day. Now think about that. Think about that. Coffs Harbour and Nambucca Heads, a paradise. I mean, what a marvellous place to be sent to if you wanted to live your life in comfort and in luxury and in paradise. But they haven't got enough doctors there, they haven't got enough specialists there to cater for the needs of the local population. If you want to get a general practitioner in Nambucca Heads, good luck. You have to book months ahead. You can't just walk in. There's a shortage of general practitioners and specialists on a plum area, regional area, like the mid-north coast. You can imagine what it's like in Dubbo. Much of it is fly in, fly out. There's a shortage of doctors in this country. And you want to have the problems of First Nations people resolved? It's not going to happen with the way that it's being done, because there's no commitment to making sure that people are there and consistently concerned and loving the work that they're doing. Everything is supposed to be solved with money. Pay people more to go there. It doesn't work. And if you have a look at the whole world has got this problem of shortage of doctors. They don't have enough doctors for the population that they have. And on the other hand, you have Cuba, which has a surfeit of doctors. They don't necessarily have the materials to be good doctors and to follow through. You could see what was happening in the hospitals. The proud Cuban health system is on its knees at the moment. And that's the situation that they're in right now. But there's a shortage of doctors. And so this is the connection with Italy. The province of Calabria had this same problem. They didn't have enough doctors for their hospitals. And so several years ago, the Calabrian provincial government invited a full brigade of Cuban medical practitioners to come and assist the province of Calabria in their hospitals. 400 to 500 people came across from Cuba and have been working in Calabria very successfully. I have to explain a little bit to you about the Cuban method that's taught to all the Cuban doctors. It rests upon respect. You are not a number. They actively try and find out about you, your character, your interests, your personality, as they're treating you. And so it's all based upon respect and upon collective responsibility and collective consciousness. So they're very popular. And wherever they go, they spread this goodwill. But of course, the US wants to stamp out everything, everything that might bring foreign exchange back to the government of Cuba. And what happens in the agreement, what happened in the agreement in Calabria was that the doctors would get 3,000 euro a month per person. 1,800 of that 3,000 went to the Cuban medical department to sustain ELAM and the medical system as it existed in Cuba. The rest went to the Cuban doctors. And that was more than they'd get back in Cuba, let me tell you. And that was how the system operated. It was working quite well. But the US is determined to stamp out any form of income that might be useful to the Cuban economy out. And so a guy called Mike Hammer, who was a consul in Italy, put the pressure on the Calabrian provincial government to stop hiring, in fact, to send them home. Just as Bolsonaro did in Brazil, he sent 8,000 Cuban doctors home, undermined them, vilified them, called them all sorts of names. They weren't properly qualified, all the rest of it. You should have seen the offers as the Cuban doctors were leaving, the big offers of big money that the Brazilian hospitals were offering them to make them stay. But this is the kind of thing that the US is up to. They want to stop the Cuban medical teams from bringing income back to Cuba. To its credit, eternal credit, the Calabrian provincial government said, no, we're not sending back those doctors. They were one of the few governments in the world, because the US has been putting pressure on all of them. They were one of the few governments in the world to reject the pressure from the US vampire. And for that I say, viva! Viva Calabria! Molto grazie! Molto grazie! Of course, Hammer wouldn't go away without some concession. The Calabrians actually wanted to employ a further 1,000 Cuban doctors next year. But he made them backtrack on that. They had to go to the open market. The US puts this narrative out that this is all slave labour and they're assisting the dictatorship in Cuba by having medical teams there. I have to say that the pressure has worked in a lot of countries surrounding Cuba. The Central American countries, the Americans have leaned on them to stop them having the Cuban doctors there. Guatemala, Ecuador, Honduras have all betrayed Cuba and sent the doctors home. You know what happened in Venezuela, of course, it was a criminal coup, and so the doctors there have been sent home. Even Jamaica, which once upon a time was an avid supporter, they too have crumbled. Only Bahamas have rejected the Americans and spoken up for Cuban medical help. I was stunned, absolutely stunned, and this is one of the great things about the Cubans. They distinguish between the governments of the people and the people themselves. But I was stunned when the Mexican government bowed to American pressure and stopped the final shipment of oil coming from Mexico to Cuba. I said, how could they possibly do that? And then I checked. And one of the things that's very apparent about the Mexican economy is that their natural gas is 90% coming from the United States. And with a stroke of the pen, the United States could double the price of that gas and create all sorts of political problems inside Mexico simply by that economic pressure. And that's what's happening in all of those states that have had to send the Cuban doctors back. They've been leaned on by the US. And please don't think that the blockade is not working here in Australia. Every year, the Australian government in the United Nations votes against the blockade.
with the other 160 or 170 odd countries, the vast bulk of them vote against the blockade. Only one or two or three US and their lackeys vote against it. Australia votes against the blockade. But I'll tell you that the ambassador that you saw earlier this evening, when they wanted to set up a new account, a new bank account in Australia, they wanted to renew their operations, not a single bank, not a single Australian bank would have anything to do with the word Cuba in their account. Fortunately, a union with attachments to a separate bank was able to get the embassy a banking account. But the banks in this country are part and parcel. This is why we can't send your donations directly through those banks. AFIDA told us that the system is every international transaction that Australian banks make goes through the mediation of American banks that supervise them all. Every single one of them. They go through the mediation of American banks. And that's where the funds can be seized and done whatever they say choose, because it's sanctioned under American law. And so, you know, what is the Australian government doing about this? We can operate by putting pressure on the Australian government to stand by its position of being against the blockade. We have to smash this blockade if we're to make any progress.
People are where they are. You're going to have to meet them where they are. And you're going to have to be generous. And that's why it comes back to the idea of friendship. Friendship is never with people who are just like you. What a boring world it would be if you only made friends with people identical to yourself. You know, then again, you might as well have imaginary friends. You want to learn from people. You want to laugh with them. You want to laugh at their limitations. They laugh at your limitations. You grow together. Yeah? So politics is also like that. If you're just stagnant, you know, if somebody enters politics age 15 and when they are 35, the same person. Terrible. They haven't grown. They haven't shaped themselves. I'm Vijay Prashad with 3CR. You better listen to it because it's really good.
A week solidarity Brekkie team listener when we were all left shaking in our sneakers. True Blue Aussie invaded by Islamic terrorists as a few women and their children managed to escape the horrific conditions of Syrian camps and invade our country. Their country, camps where they made their own bed and could lie on it. Big Supremo Anthony Albanese displayed the compassion of a man raised by a single mum in public housing. As an aside for younger listener, public housing was housing owned by the state that provided low-cost rentals before government realised housing monies were best spent on the private sector. Anyway, Anthony's compassion was topped by the caring business class Hayseed and Cheapshit Coalition, who warned us we would not be safe in our beds or anywhere else if the socialists didn't prevent these mothers and children with True Blue Aussie passports coming to True Blue Aussie. So here we all are, scared out of our minds. And we have the proof. Since similar mothers and children were repatriated under the previous coalition government, we've all known firsthand what a terrorist threat they turned out to be. If only they didn't have those passports, we could at least pack them off to Nauru under our bilateral compassionate policies reflecting the courage of invertebrate socialism. That invertebrate courage to the fore yet again last week when Zion seized a flotilla on the open seas, attempting to provide humanitarian aid to the Gazan non-land, non-people. The arrested, including a number of True Blue Aussies, the governments of the arrested denouncing Zion for its lawlessness. Well, not all the governments. True Blue Aussies said it had warned the True Blue Aussies not to join the flotilla. Courage personified. Not one word about lawlessness, piracy on the open seas, let alone condemnation of the blockade of Gaza's waterways itself, totally illegal. Illegal piracy defending an illegal blockade. But true blue Aussie concedes Zion's right to illegality. After all, we do provide the parts for the train killer jets conducting the slaughter, destruction, genocide and starvation. So let's not threaten those profits by goody-goodies attempting to assist in the starvation bit. Gazans mightn't have made their own bed, but they can lie on it. Or could, except their bed, like them, is a victim of the slaughter and destruction and genocide bits. Meanwhile, slaughter and destruction, Zion's parallel war on evil Iran with Supremo Benjamin, not another Yahoo's puppet, US of the UN of the US of the world, big Supremo Donald Trump of the poor, is over, according to US Obs Secretary for World State Marco Rubout Evil Cubio, is not over, according to Donald, while good old Project Freedom in the Strait of Hormuz was on hold, according to Donald, and full steam ahead, according to Marco. So the war is over and not over. And Project Freedom is on hold and not on hold, showing yet again the right hand doesn't know what the right hand's doing. Oh, and that giant mind Peter Hug Killer stuff, the secretary portraying killing and being offensive, said, direct quote, "We're not looking for a fight," which would probably bear a lot more credibility if they stroke he hadn't started the fight in the first place. Thank goodness True Blue Aussie has former big-time train killer Andrew Hastie for battle in Parliament to warn us that despite the socialists spending more and more on train killing, matching it with spending less and less on people with disabilities, for instance, Andrew knows it's not enough. It's time, he said, to stop the weasel words and speak about the threat China poses. If the public knew how likely conflict is in our own region, they would be marching in the streets demanding higher train killer spending. Thank you, Andrew, for alerting us. And there's one sure way to engender a threat. Keep telling us our biggest trading partner is a threat. But surely, in principle, Andrew must therefore argue we must cut all economic ties with evil China, unlike our economic ties with our peace-loving good friends Benjamin and Donald. And good to know Andrew supports people marching in the streets for the proper reasons, and marching to end slaughter, destruction, genocide and starvation are not proper reasons. The Corporate Perspicacity Award of the Week, well earned by privatised energy giant AG Hell for Mother Earth, alerting us to a little problem we'd never have noticed. AI data set, as it announced breathlessly, are a massive drain on energy resources. Who would have thought? Just when we were embracing them as a social godsend. Thanks, AG Hell 4, for detecting it and alerting us. Your Corporate Perspicacity of the Week award is on its way, where we're sure it will hang proudly on your boardroom wall. Evil unions argue another small AI problem is the potential loss of thousands and thousands of jobs. A small problem, the socialist responsible AI practitioners concede, but point out it's not a problem worth worrying about, which must be a salve for the thousands and thousands. The job losses will be balanced out because AI will also come up with the solutions, reminding me of an environmentalist years ago who said, no doubt, when they chopped down the last tree on Easter Island, they also said technology will come to the rescue. Find the answer. True to form, the evil unions want to have a say in its implementation and impact on the workforce, and true to form, the socialists displayed their dedication to the workers. The reason so many evil unions support the socialists financially and physically on the ground. Caring business class relations minister Amanda Rush, not worth much, told a conference of the AI data center practitioners the government would not give the evil unions and lazy avaricious workers a say in how AI affects them. Any wonder caring employers and their media spokespeople know the socialists are hostage to the evil unions. That's why dedicated evil union bureaucrats will continue to put their bums on the plush parliamentary seats so they too can support workers just like Amanda. Workers like academics at Deakin University who claim the, quote, relentless pursuit of profits has created a dangerous, toxic workplace marked by systemic wage theft and extreme workloads for staff. Thankfully, this outrageous claim was exposed for what it is by the university, which categorically denies the allegations. Staff are actively encouraged to raise concerns, it boasted, and, well, they've certainly taken up the offer. Wonder which side Amanda would support. And the evil union nonsense can be discounted because we all know tertiary institutions do not exist to make a profit. They are all about education. And once again, special thanks to the then vice-chancellors for their courage under fire when former big supremo little Johnny Howhart ordered them to become commercial, slashing government support. Slashing household incomes, the reserve losses bank, interest rates up again because fighting inflation is far more important than making the poor even poorer. Indeed, that's a positive. As Bank Supremo Michelle Bouldas pointed out, government support for the most needy is a major problem for the economy, although apparently making mortgage repayments even higher is not inflation. A certain consolation for those forking out all that extra and those who took up the government's low, low deposit scheme who increasingly are finding repayments impossible. Still, it's better than the government wasting all that support on, say, public housing, which, as we've mentioned, is a relic of past public waste. And a real positive, while households copped another whack, financial advisers, the big practitioners of the greatest little economic order of them all, were advising on the best investments to make a killing out of the rate rise. Win-win. Not quite win-win, apparently. Government wanting some gas reserve for domestic use. This would, we guessed it, threaten investment, the giant pollution behemoth screamed. But the good news is that the fuel crisis created by Benjamin and Donald has highlighted the need for more and more and more fossils. As the fossil minister Chris Bowen at Capital explained, right now addressing climate change is not on his to-do list. Good luck, Mother Earth. And finally, jot July 28 down on our diary, the must-read, not-to-be-missed event of the year, the release of Riding the Jet Stream, the, quote, tell-all memoir by former airline, which used to be our airline supremo, Alan Joystick, an instructive read for future leaders. Well, that's us, listener. And a chance for the businessman to set the record straight after a turbulent end to his time at the airline. And we can be sure we can rely on the accuracy of that. And the publisher says it's a story of, quote, ambition, intellect, and steel. No, no, listener, wrong, wrong, wrong. Steel is spelt S-T-E-E-L. Good morning.
And good morning to you, Kevin. This is Solidarity Breakfast with Tabea, Annie and Anila. And in the studio, we're joined by Spike and Kelly from the Homeless Persons Union. Hello, guys.
Good morning.
Hey, how you going?
Yeah, and one of the things that's important for us to realise is that next Tuesday at, if you're really keen, 4:30 is some tunes and five speeches. Part of the big lean at the town hall, Melbourne Town Hall. Can you give our listeners a little bit of a background to why this is such an important event?
Okay.
Looking at you, what, Spike. Why is
it, it's an important event because the City of Melbourne has implemented a program, what they're calling a community safety officer program, that is incredibly punitive and oppressive, and they're using quasi-military detail. Initially, it was to protect their bylaws officers in doing their work, like when they're waking people up and throwing people's stuff away. So when bylaws officers were doing their work. Then they said it was to connect homeless people to services. Now they're saying it's to enhance public safety and to deter antisocial behaviour. So it's moved over to... And now Kelly said something earlier about empathy.
They're calling it... It's about amenity.
I thought he said...
And they're trained in quote-unquote empathy.
So, I mean, it's not funny. I shouldn't laugh. But I guess you laugh because... The ridiculous nature of this, the impact that it's having on people's lives and their impact and their ability to enjoy public space as a human right, not and something that we should be really angry about. And so the Big Lean is about bringing people together to show their solidarity to oppose the criminalisation of our homeless community, because they're pushing people out of the CBD, and they're also
They're also redefining community. Who are part of the community?
Right. That's right.
A question I have about this is that I think, you know, a lot of people who've never experienced homelessness might think, well, why does it matter where you end up? You know, you're living on the street. Why does it matter if you can't be in that area of the city that you're usually in? And I think it would be helpful to talk a little bit about the fact that there are communities and there are homes, in a sense, on the street, and it matters that people get to stay where they want to stay.
You're so right. Prior to COVID, and at the inception of the union, the community of homeless, of unhoused people in the CBD was quite large. They were supporting each other. They were sharing food. Some people were writing poetry. They were collecting sandwiches from the shops. The people they were really organised. They were collecting food that wasn't being used and sharing it amongst themselves in the city square, planning get-togethers. Like, it was a genuine community. Over time, that slowly dwindled because of the attack on their rights by different levels of security, PSOs, bylaws officers, now CSOs. And they've been pushing people out through exclusion orders and making it difficult to survive.
One of the things I find really concerning about this is that surely this is a safety issue as well. Like, you were talking about people, I think before we went on air, we were having a chat about the fact that some of these people are being moved on at, 7 p.m. at night after dark, being told that they need to either have their stuff removed, find a new place to go. That's an incredibly high risk position to put someone in the middle of the night, to go and find a safe place to sleep for the night.
Yeah, and one of the recordings we're going to play, if that's okay, on the show in the next half hour is a young woman we spoke to just the other day at a breakfast in town, and she was telling us a story of how, women, she feels it as a woman especially, getting moved out of the CBD, they feel safer there. There's more lighting, there's more cameras, there's more people around. So it's actually putting them into danger by moving them into other municipalities where there's less of those things around.
And sorry, just quick, just as human beings, we want to feel affinity with other people. You know, no one wants to live, very few people, unless there's times when we want to be by ourselves, but we're generally social beings and we feel a need to interact with others.
Let's listen to the first of your vox pop with some of the people that are actually being affected by this system that the Melbourne City Council is putting forward.
Women on the street are basically strong. A friend of mine just lost her house. She's got a six-month-old child and she was staying in the CBD near the Big W. The security guard walked up, gave her a notice to leave the CBD area. She's not allowed in to get food, nothing, can't even come into servos. She basically has to go smelly. She can't even come in to get, like, breakfast. The security guard took her phone, her wallet, everything off her. She's not allowed 200 metres in the CBD because she's had a pram and two trolleys and having a child on the street. I've had like a couple of like incidents with them. Like, when I first come back to Melbourne, I was on the street and I only had like two suitcases with me, and I got kicked out of the CBD area because I've had two suitcases. And like they've said to me, I'm not allowed to have any suitcases, no backpacks, nothing. Yeah, and gave me a notice to leave the CBD area. And like, I've asked them for like the security card to make sure it is correct. And like, them getting how they're acting and how they treat women and making women go from the CBD where there's more facilities to St Kilda where there's nothing. Like, it's basically unfair. More cameras for the women and there's more, like, protection. Like, the Melbourne East Police Station's open 24/7 and St Kilda Police Station Collingwood's not 24 hours. My cousin, who was raped and bashed on Melbourne Central Station, she was raped and bashed there and she got moved to St Kilda and she's no longer around no more because she got moved from Melbourne Central, like the CBD area, to St Kilda, and a week after she got moved, she got killed. Like, all homeless should have their rights too. Like, it's not their fault that they're homeless. The council needs to basically do more. There's not enough homeless shelters for anyone to basically go to. Like, I basically found all the supports of mine. Like, there was domestic violence and plus other reasons why I ended up on the street, like sexual assault. That's what, like, these security guards need to realise, and the council, what actually causes women to go, like, missing or self-harming, because they don't understand what us women...
One of the things that's really important for people to realise isn't just that the Melbourne City Council is on this trajectory. There are several councils around Melbourne that are taking the same approach. Can you talk to that?
Windham, City of Melbourne. City of Port Phillip's just ushered in their heinous bylaw change Wednesday evening. And I think it's City of Yarra is geared up to do the same in the next month or two. So we'll be preparing for that as well. They want to change their bylaw. At the moment, they consider people that are homeless as a class of people in the community that are exempt from the camping laws, which mean you can't be camping in the municipality, and people that are homeless are exempt from that. They want to change that so that it will be left to the discretion of the local law officer. And that's just not good enough.
It isn't. And it's, I guess it's really important to be able to see it as a manifestation of what's happening on a geopolitical level, like the extreme right. It's a reactionary right-wing wave of sort of right-wing sort of politics that's sweeping through local government, scapegoating people experiencing poverty for the situation they're in. Rather than targeting systemic failure, they're blaming the individual.
On that note, we were talking briefly about earlier in the break about the fact that there's a distinctly Victorian kind of feel to this approach to people experiencing poverty, and the idea that it's a moral failing to be homeless or to be experiencing hardship. So could you talk a little bit about why it isn't a moral failure to be on the street?
It's part of how capitalism operates. It's very ingenious in focusing on blaming the individual because of the way the media fails to criticise the federal government, state government and local government for their failures in investment in services. You know, they're saying they want to connect people to services. Services turn 300 people away every week.
Not to mention that they want to knock down four... the towers.
Yeah. So it's a very sophisticated, even though it looks fragmented and all these issues are sort of seem sort of isolated. It's a sophisticated campaign to sell off public land and to keep people off public property. Actually, it's taking back they're taking back the common space. It's almost like a neo-feudalism.
Yeah, I agree. I think so too. Do you want to play another one of the voices from the street?
Just a lot of normal people looking for tickets. That was all right. Then they started putting these security fucking things, giving them guns. No, it's like they escalated. You whack a vest on and all of a sudden they're fucking hard. They stole my fucking jackets. You don't touch it. This is like going up to a Hell's Angel taking off his fucking jacket. You know, like, you don't do that shit. They're just trying to, it's like they were the kids in school that got picked on And all of a sudden they got fucking uniforms or some shit. Now they fucking, you go from one area to the next and they just pop out of nowhere. It's like, I don't know if they're in communication with each other. But yeah, they're pushing you further out onto the street. Me, 3-4 times a day. And at night too, like, you know. I get it, some people make a mess everywhere, but that's not everyone. You know, you barely, I sit somewhere and I got, you know, I clean up after myself, everything. Barely anyone touches my shit, you know? Yeah, they're a problem. For me personally, they're the problem. I got dropped off. They did a drive-through through that federal police station or whatever, the big one, across the rest of the map. Drive through, then they register, thing goes, nah, because I've already been through. And they drove up, and he was pissed off. So they dropped me off all the way at the fucking Westgate Bridge to walk back. And while my shit was all still left on the street. Two jackets and a Lego Technic thing with a dinosaur and shit like that. That's for my kids. This makes me see red. Female officers. Maybe accompanied by a male or something like that. Because females have a calming, yeah, basically, yes, they do. Because people on the streets have got a different constitution, basically, you know? And they don't understand it. You know, it's like, it's hard to explain. It's like, yeah. They have not walked. If they gave jobs to us, instead of people that aren't from our communities, then it'd be hell, like, it'd be an instant, like, all we have to do is just say, you know, because we already know each other. Plus, we're out here, like, you know what I mean? We could even have a rotation in shifts, you know, we get a job, like, work a couple of weeks, I'll be working, then the next one, like, you know what I mean? There you go, problem, a lot of...
We're on Solidarity Breakfast with Anila, Annie and Tabea. And in the studio, we've got Spike and Kelly from the Homeless Persons Union. And they're talking to us about the issue of the Community Protection Officers, CPO, whatever they call them. I don't know what they're called. But the Melbourne City Council, basically a thinly disguised get rid of homeless people from public spaces in Melbourne City. There's a big lean protest because the Homeless People's Union are very effective at reframing the issue, which is that people are being moved from public spaces and we're going to lean on the wall in front of the town hall to show that, in fact, the public own the public spaces, not the bureaucracy. I was just listening to that and I was just enraged at the idea of having to drop somebody off miles away from their stuff, so passive aggressive. You know, you can't put your finger on the power that causes someone so much inconvenience. It's just a tragedy, really, isn't it?
Yeah. Yes. I don't know what more to say about that, but we were talking a bit off air about something.
Yeah, I just was interested in, I mean, we hear a lot about people's stories, but also I think it'd be important for listeners to understand just what ways in which people are being moved on or being stopped from, you know, having whatever sleep they can possibly get. I mean, my mum's over here from Perth and she was saying one of the ways that recently got overturned but was used for a bit was that they were had speakers emitting a sound that was uncomfortable for human hearing to stop people from sleeping under bridges. So like you were saying to that, Spike, was that it's actually torture tactics. And
making it impossible for people to get... So you're in a state of constant hypervigilance. You know, it's like putting broken glass in places where people normally would sleep or barbed wire or massive... Or they do it with pot plants to make it look like it's not aggressive. It's actually incredibly aggressive. Put a massive pot plants when people would normally sort of have a kip and making it just incredibly difficult just to exist, merely exist. Not doing next level stuff like, you know, finding work and developing community and you know, maintaining relationships, simply to exist. It's turned into an obstacle course.
Where are are people supposed to go, in fact? I mean, homelessness exists.
But beyond that, I mean, what you're saying is, like, they're expending an incredible amount of resources in funding all these security officers and putting in all this hostile architecture and all this other stuff, when they could just as easily redirect that money to funding community programs, funding...
Employing people that are homeless or have been homeless to work with homeless community, to, you know, train them to be overdose response workers, to be mental health workers. There's one guy who we spoke to yesterday. He almost, like, I listened to his interview again last night. He almost had me in tears because of the way he summarised the impact of mental health and the way, you know, from the perspective of someone on the street. From the perspective of lived experience and someone on the street, he totally knocked it on the head, and I thought, mate, this guy could be an advocate.
And that's what we want to do.
That's exactly
right. With
the
union. We want to, you know, be able to raise money so that we can have programs where we can lift people up, and they can be the advocates, and we will support them until they don't need to be supported anymore. Right. Like, that's our long-term dream.
Work ourselves out of a job, basically.
Yeah.
Fundamentally, it's a community development project. That's what that's what our union's about. And I think I'm hoping that by playing these interviews and these testimonies, we're able to raise the voice of people who never ever heard ever. They've always got a worker, some sort of professional academic speaking on their behalf, and so. That's not to criticise professional folks. They need to do what they need to do. But the people, when you listen to what people tell us, the people who are having a lived experience, and you actually give them the time and actually actively listen, you'll hear that they get it.
They have the expertise, yeah. Not the City of Melbourne bureaucrats, and that's the 100%. Problem. They don't have those folks in the town hall, yeah, helping to shape those policies and processes, 100%. And that's why they're not doing what they should be doing.
And a vital role that you guys play is also in shattering the kind of myth-making that the City of Melbourne or other councils do when they talk about, you know, what was the camera program called, Safe Cities or whatever it was called, how they ramped out thousands more cameras. They're used to target, or they're trained to target the most vulnerable first and then coerce the rest of us that are using the cities. So actually what you do as a twofold role is bring people's voices to spaces like 3CR and other places and give them a place so people can hear them.
And just a quick shout out to all the other fabulous people who, yeah, are working with this space, like the range of community legal centres across Melbourne who are really strong advocates in this space, or their clients, yeah, you know, are experiencing these hardships. And also the other small grassroots community, Vixen and Footscray Community Response and Care Not Cruelty in Port Phillip are also working really, really hard. And
criticise people, but, you know, services, you know, peak bodies have been silent. They've left people, they've left the homeless community, they've hung them out to dry, I want to use a cliche here, it's an absolute disgrace that the people who have the resources, who have the time, who have the ear of government and different forums aren't speaking up about this stuff, because it's important to understand it's not just the CSOs. It's different. If you listen to the testimonies, it's people are confused about the different levels of security: PSOs, CSOs, private security that are employed by retails, cops, and that's what they're having to deal with, and it makes people's lives incredibly difficult.
We can go to one of those last interviews now while we still have time.
Yep. Have you been asked to move on?
Yep, plenty of times. I was asleep, and they told me, they woke me up, and they go, look, you can't sleep here, can you move on? Until, it was after, 7:30 at night, and I was just looking for somewhere to sleep, really. I just had more or less what I got on.
So have you ever had your stuff taken by the City of Melbourne?
Yeah.
Did you get it back?
No.
Did they tell you that you could get it back?
No, they didn't even tell me that.
Did they leave you a card or something to tell you?
A little, a business card, something that size.
And did you ever get your stuff back?
Nah, I'm still waiting on it.
So how does that impact you?
I just feel like
crap, really.
Did you have ID and stuff?
No, I've had no ID.
Do you think that being moved on should be illegal?
Yeah, because there's nowhere really else to go besides under roofs, which is H&M and a couple of other little places.
So it's really tough to find shelter, right?
Yeah, too tough, yeah.
What would you like people to know, the council? What would you like the council to know about what it's like to be homeless?
Oh, how hard it is, and it's not easy to get stuff and like getting clothes and blankets and all that in one go.
Are you on employment benefits?
Yeah, just job seeker at the moment.
Just job seeker. How hard is it to survive on that?
Yeah, it's pretty hard because I've got there's me and then I've got my five kids. So,
is there anything else you'd like the council to know about what it's like to be homeless and be moved on?
Go out and spend the night on the street, see how they feel.
And we're coming to an end now. Thanks for coming in, Callie and Spike. But can you give our listeners a roundup of the event, the Big Lean, and also the fact that there's a council meeting after it?
Yeah, so we're going to start rocking up this coming Tuesday from 4:30 p.m. We're going to have DJ me and Marcel spinning tunes, creating a powerful community vibe. So you're welcome to start rocking in from then. And then at 5 o'clock, we're going to have a few short speeches from the HPUV, from Vixen, from Footscray Community Response. And we'll have a short open mic, so people are welcome to get up and speak to community then. At 5:30, we're actually going to have the Big Lean, so we want everybody to set themselves upon the town hall. We'll snake around the building. We'll have a great photographer there. We'll have the tunes playing. Bring a sign, bring a friend, bring a co-worker. Just come and be there. And then from 5:45 p.m. thereabouts, we'll head into the City of Melbourne meeting where they're going to be discussing. Well, they're actually not going to be discussing. They want to hear from you, your views on their idea to expand the Community Safety Officer program. So, yeah, please come. We'd love to see you there.
Yeah. Please come and show your opposition to this crazy program and show your solidarity with the city's unhoused community.
Thank you very much, and we'll see you there.
Yep, and we're coming to the end. Coming up next is Asia Pacific Currents.
Shops, security following me. And when I'm great, I'm the very best that you'll ever see. I can't decide of all this attention, 'cause everybody jealous of me.
When you walk into the room and everyone looking at you like somebody totally on and they all know it but you.
Sharp as a thumbtack, your water off a duck's back. Your chat don't stick to me. Crap talkers need a bottle of Listerine. I don't hold that shame, no mystery. I got 70,000 years of history. Faster, stronger, spirit and mind. And I'm a sucker to you every time. You know, you know, you know, you know that your friends all feeling my grind. Straight jealousy. In the room, there's an elephant in the form of my heart, melanin. No race cards, I'm telling them. I'ma take charge in the graveyard full of
skeletons. When you walk into the room and everyone looking at you like somebody totally on it, they all know it but you.
Wanna fall through the floor, make a run to the door. Makes me cutty, but I'm so dirty. I'm not gonna have no
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.